Case number 25-7046. Mohammed Farhad Mia, individually and on behalf of proposed class members et al. Appellants versus Kimberly Clark Corporation et al. Mr. Collinsworth for the appellants, Mr. Zients for the appellees.
Good morning.
Good morning.
And start when you're ready.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. I am Terry Collinsworth, and I'm with the International Rights Advocates, and we represent the 13 men who brought this case, who were among many victims of trafficking and forced labor being moved from Bangladesh to Malaysia to work in various factories, including the Brightway factory at issue here. Kimberly Clark Corporation, I'll call them KCC, and Ansell have conceded that the 13 plaintiffs were trafficked and forced to work in the Brightway Group factory. And the issue here is whether they, KCC and Ansell, are liable with Brightway for the forced labor and trafficking. Overall, we're here to look at the scope of the Trafficking Victims Protection Act, the TVPRA. Excuse me. And in doing so, I'd like to read a brief quote from the sponsors of the TVPRA, who filed a brief in the Supreme Court in Nestle USA versus Doe, speaking about the scope of the TVPRA. And they said, quote, "It is not enough to target the traffickers themselves. Effective anti-trafficking policy requires disincentives directed towards those who benefit from trafficking, including corporate actors who knowingly profit from trafficking in their supply chain." And that's at 2020 Westlaw 6322316 at 1920. And we submit that that's the scope, the intended scope of the TVPRA applies to both KCC and Ansell here, because they, according to Section 1595A of the Trafficking Victims Protection Act, they knowingly profited from forced labor in this case. Now, we have a lot of issues here. Whether I'm going to briefly list them, whether there is a 1595A venture, whether KCC and Ansell should have known, knew or should have known of the forced labor and trafficking at Brightway, whether the statute applies extraterritorially in this case, and then we have common law claims for unjust enrichment and negligent supervision. I'd like to initially focus my limited time on the two factually intensive questions, whether there was a venture and the state of knowledge for KCC and Ansell. The issue of extraterritorial jurisdiction, of course, I'm here to respond to any questions, but it's well briefed in our opening brief at 10 to 27 and the reply brief at 5 to 14. And we have an amicus brief filed by the Legal Scholars Group. But
before you move off of extraterritoriality, so under RJR Nabisco, there are two ways, I guess, I call them steps, not exactly steps, but either the statute as a whole applies extraterritorially or the focus of the statute could be domestic. So if just assume for a minute that I don't think the statute applies extraterritorially, what is the best evidence that the plaintiffs have put forward that there is a domestic effect in the United States? Because the forced labor all occurred abroad.
Right. Thank you, Your Honor. Well, I hope we're not done with the issue of whether it does apply extraterritorially. I think that in the briefs and all of the cases, particularly in our opening brief at 10 to 11, we have about a dozen cases that say that it does extend entirely extraterritorially. But I think in terms of the domestic application, part two of R.J. Reynolds, 1589B of the forced labor statute makes it an offense to benefit from the forced labor itself. And we think in the amicus brief and our brief both emphasize that 1589B clearly makes it a domestic violation if you benefit in the U.S.
So are the benefits, is the benefit just sufficient for it to be just commercial benefits, just profits?
That's the thing.
Does there have to be some connection between those profits or some action that the defendants have taken to show that they're in a venture and that, you know, that shouldn't there have to be some greater effects domestically?
Well, the question in 1595A itself is, some form of benefit. And in this case, it is, in fact, financial. It's profit. They had low-cost gloves produced at a factory that was using forced labor and trafficked labor. So our argument under 1589B is that they, sitting in the U.S., received higher profits from the lower costs of that factory. And, of course, that assumes they are in a venture, which I'm planning to cover.
Do the plaintiffs allege anything other than profits occurred domestically?
Well, they have the benefit of a steady supply source of cheap labor gloves from Brightway because of their long-term relationship with the factory. But at the end of the day, it is profit. They're benefiting from the cost savings of not having a factory that meets their own standards that they claim they try to apply.
That's an argument that 1589B, the substantive law, applies to knowingly benefiting in the United States from trafficking abroad.
That's correct.
And the lingo of extraterritoriality is to say that the focus of 1589B is on the knowingly benefiting.
That's correct, Your Honor.
But even if all of that is true, you still have to show that the cause of action applies. There's a step zero to RJR, which is you have to separately analyze substantive law and cause of action. And if you just apply RJR, the focus, even if you have domestic conduct, the focus of the cause of action is on the injury. And here, the injuries all happened abroad.
The 1589B expands the focus, which we did plead, to also whether the companies benefited from the forced labor. So the forced labor absolutely occurred abroad, but whether you benefited from it in the United States, and it makes it a domestic application, it's in our complaint, and 1589B only exists. It would otherwise be redundant to make sure that the person benefiting from it in the United States is equally liable to the direct perpetrator, and that's textual.
That's just an argument that extending the geographic scope of the substantive law determines the geographic scope of the cause of action, that there's no separate requirement of a domestic injury for a cause of action.
Well, the domestic injury is the profiting from. And
no, the domestic injury to the plaintiffs is being trafficked on the other side of the globe.
Right, and that is their cause of action.
That is not domestic. None of the injuries is domestic.
None of the injuries are, but 1589B explicitly makes it.
1589B is substantive law.
Yes.
Just like in RJR, the substantive law 1962 applied to domestic and extraterritorial conduct, and that didn't answer the question about the geographic scope of 1964, the cause of action for which the court said you need a domestic injury.
So you didn't have a...
Why doesn't that logic equally govern here?
Because they didn't have an explicit statute like we do, 1589B, which simply says whoever knowingly benefits financially, and that's case Kimberly Clark.
RICO, which incorporated predicates, some of which were just as extraterritorial as 1589B, and some of which were exclusively extraterritorial.
1589B is exclusively domestic, and that's what both we and the legal scholars establish in our briefing on that, that it exists solely to allow for that domestic injury. And then if you look at the Rodriguez versus Pan American Health Association specifically held at 29F4706 at 716 that the financial benefit, I'm quoting, the financial benefit that violates 1589B is itself wrongful conduct and occurred in the United States.
That case tends to support you on the proposition that 1589B covers domestic benefiting.
Yes, absolutely.
But that doesn't answer my what's troubling me with your position, which is the difference between the substantive law and the cause of action, which is what RJR was all about.
Well, again, RJR has had two steps, and we think we satisfied the first step, but the second
step. Does the cause of action here in 1595A use the word injury? That's what Judge Cassis was talking about, because it did use injury to business or property in RICO.
It simply says an individual who is a victim of a violation of this chapter.
So it doesn't require an injury in the United States.
No, it does not.
An injury to property or business.
No, it does not.
It requires that the plaintiff be a victim of a violation of this statute.
That's correct. And I think a
plaintiff can be a victim of a violation without an injury from the misconduct.
They have to show that they were a victim of one of the substantive provisions of the chapter. And in this case, we're alleging they were both forced labor and trafficking. But 1589B does not require that we demonstrate that injury. It requires only that we demonstrate a benefit to KCC and Ansel.
Can you be a victim if your injury occurred abroad rather than domestically?
Yes. If it applies extraterritorially, but I think
any question that any of these I hadn't thought at this stage that there was any question that any of the plaintiffs here were severely injured by the forced labor and trafficking.
They would in the allegations of the complaint, we show that they were subjected to slavery like conditions. They suffered physically. They suffered mentally. They indeed were very much physically injured by the actions that occurred to them and that are really undisputed in this case. I see I'm really eating into my
rebuttal. Put aside geographic scope. Just do you agree that the cause of action, the word victim in the cause of action requires both some kind of injury and some kind of causal relationship between the misconduct and the injury to be a victim?
Yes, you have to demonstrate that you were injured by, you were a victim of one of the substantive causes of action. 1589 and 1590 are the two that are at issue here. I see that I only have 3 minutes left, and I wanted some.
Sir, can I just ask you another question about that, which is, even if we assume that the benefits that could just be simply profits in the United States, why wouldn't the plaintiffs have to show that there was participation in a venture that occurred domestically? You know, something specific about how the companies participated in a venture domestically. I don't see any allegations of that sort in the plaintiff's complaint.
I don't think we have to show that. I think we have to show that we have to satisfy 1595A, that they were participants in a venture that, in fact, engaged in the forced labor and trafficking. So their participation, they don't have to be sitting in Malaysia to participate in that venture. We allege that they participated in it by investing in this factory and by supporting it across the years and other indicia that we allege in the complaint of their support for that and their participation in the venture.
So then there would be no limitation. I mean, basically any domestic corporation could be held liable for forced labor abroad
if they
were participating in a venture. So there would be no extraterritorial limit at all under.
According to 1589B, no. But there's a huge limit. They have to have first been participants in the venture that did the wrongful acts. And then if they did, they can't sit in the U.S. and say, we didn't do it because we're here in the U.S. No, you benefited from it here in the U.S., so that creates another form of liability. We do think that the entire statute, as we argue in our brief, is extraterritorial, which would remove that as a problem in any event. But we think that we can reach them in both prongs for extraterritorial liability.
But if it doesn't pass, if it's not extraterritorial under prong one, then your reading of prong two would make it extraterritorial in any case where there was a venture.
Because of 1589B, yes, which is explicit. I have 1 minute left for my rebuttal. I think I should stop, or will the court grant me additional time?
On the venture question, how do you distinguish Apple?
Thank you.
It feels like pretty similar.
Well, as you well know, Apple has multiple prongs for how you can show participation in a venture. You can show a common purpose, you can share profits and risks, you can show control, or a direct and continuous relationship. Any one of those will suffice. And the word or does indicate that. We think we satisfy all of the factors, and I can quickly run through the first one, which is a direct and continuous relationship. We have multiple allegations showing the simple fact of the years of KCC and Ansell using Brightway as a direct supplier. That's easy, but just briefly, paragraphs 1, 29, 30, 48, 69, 58, 101, 102, and 107 show that.
I get that you allege how long this relationship went on. I'm just trying to understand. I did not read Apple as sort of saying it's just a question of time. As long as if you have the type of contractual relationship, the buyer-seller relationship that was going on in Apple, you have that and you don't... And you just have to have it a certain amount of time. I mean, that's what you've alleged is how long, but I don't understanding the relevance of that.
Sure. Well, I think the actual wording of Apple was a direct and continuous relationship.
And continuous.
Direct and continuous. Okay. That's a quote. But in this case, I acknowledge we could argue that that's enough. But I acknowledge that some other courts have said, well, you need a little something more, like to show that they had skin in the game or they were participants in some way other than just simply across the years buying the product. And we have that here. Paragraph 103, I will quote, KCC provided Brightway with a significant amount of Brightway's machinery and molds used in manufacturing latex gloves. Also, at one point, KCC owned one of Brightway's factories and sold it to them at a great discount to allow them to continue to produce.
I'm trying to understand. So, if I've got the history right, KCC was at Kimberly-Clark was at one point operating in Malaysia and then decided to leave. Is that when they sort of sold the company, sold the factory to Brightway?
My understanding from our pleadings is that KCC owned a factory for a while and Brightway was using it and then it sold it to them at a discount.
When Kimberly-Clark left.
Yes. Country. Yes.
That was just where. So it wasn't like they, from their long distance relationship in the United States as a buyer or seller, that they said, oh, you need a factory? Let's buy a whole new factory for you. It's that they were leaving the country, they were selling.
And they wanted
whatever
it.
Their factory was, and they sold it to Brightway.
And gave them a bunch of equipment and materials to make sure that they could boost Brightway's.
They gave new stuff or was it what was left in the factory?
Well, that we don't know. We know that they gave them a bunch of equipment. And that's my point here about that issue. That paragraph one.
I guess I can imagine it being different that if, in addition to being a buyer or seller, they were sort of sending in all kinds of equipment on an ongoing basis. But I'm trying to understand what your complaint alleges because it seems to me it's equally fairly read as, if not more fairly read as Malaysia, Kimberly-Clark had its factory in Malaysia, decided to leave the country, and it sold what it was leaving behind to Brightway or to the highest bidder, which happened to be Brightway.
Well, they were partnered with Brightway and other factories before that, but a reasonable inference is that they gave them this equipment and they gave them materials and they've sold them a cheap factory in order to continue to boost and build Brightway's business. But the error here is that the district court...
They didn't sell it to somebody.
Well, they chose their venture partner to boost them, not anyone else.
Well, I understand why you're using that language, but I'm not sure.
That's the allegation.
Just evidence... like the selling of the machinery, isn't that just further evidence of a commercial relationship, an ordinary commercial relationship? It doesn't show that they were participating in a venture to benefit from forced labor.
Well, they knew about the forced labor at the time, and it shows that they wanted to help Brightway. And the legal error here is that the district court not only didn't take our allegation as true and give us the benefit of reasonable inferences, at page 88 of the joint appendix, the district court dismissed that allegation and said that they provided, quote, off-the-shelf materials and machinery. That degraded the allegation. It didn't give us the benefit.
Why it's a reasonable inference that this, you know, giving molds and machinery leads to an inference of participation of venture for forced labor.
We have to show something more than a long-term and continuous relationship. So what we have shown is that KCC much like in Salesforce, which provided direct assistance to the business that they were working with there. And here.
But in Salesforce, they provided targeted help to assist them in their forced labor and trafficking advertisements.
Well, here, we have allegations and well-briefed that KCC and Ansel knew or should have known about the forced labor and trafficking when they were doing business in a long-term and continuous relationship. And instead of giving it to somebody else or giving somebody else a deal, they sold this equipment or they gave the equipment and gave a good deal on the factory to build and boost this very business that they knew was producing cheap gloves because it was using forced labor and trafficked labor. And then in paragraphs 59 and 101, we have Ansel providing assistance to Brightway by helping them with their remediation plans in order to try to get from behind the withhold release order that CBP imposed to keep them in business because they were also their long-term business partner in a venture.
In Salesforce, the provision of something beyond just buyer-sell relationship was itself on a continuous basis, right? The computer provision?
Yes.
Right, okay. But what you allege is a sort of one-off, probably sold them the factory when they left the country and may well have sold them the machinery and molds when they left the country. But you allege that it happened, they provided it to them. You don't say they were every year sending them new machinery and new molds.
Well, shortly after this, the WRO occurred, and they then began trying to help Brightway to prepare remediation plans and also to be able to sell back in the United States. So that became their form of assistance, which obviously assumes that there was forced labor and trafficking. The WRO occurred.
I'm not sure that just doesn't mean if you want to stay in business with us, you've got to clean up your act here.
Well, they were directly helping them. And if it was by doing remediation plans, by showing them how to do it.
Remediation plan, what do you mean?
Well, in their own reporting in paragraph 59 and 101, Ansel said to the WRO, to the CBP, that they're, don't worry, we're helping with the remediation plans. We're going to get them back up to speed.
I don't know what that means. I don't mean setting standards for them.
Better forms of enforcement, better forms of monitoring so that there would not be forced labor and trafficking in the future. And if they were just mere purchasers of these gloves from Brightway, they could have gone to anybody else.
Does your complaint allege... I thought your complaint alleged that the forced labor and trafficking at issue here sort of ended at the time of the WRO. Am I wrong? As to these plaintiffs?
As to the plaintiffs, yes.
So what happened after that?
The plaintiffs?
No, what you're talking about, all this stuff about remediation is something that post-states.
Right. That's just
plaintiffs and their asserted injuries. And so...
That's just evidence, Your Honor, that they had more than a mere buyer-seller relationship. They were working with Brightway to get them back online so they could continue doing business with them. If they were mere purchasers and didn't care who they bought their gloves from, they could have gone down the street to XYZ factory instead. But they stuck with Brightway because they had a long-term relationship with them and they were in a venture together.
Okay, and that relationship is a buyer-seller relationship. Long-term buyer-seller relationship.
With the kind of assistance that Salesforce pointed to show that it was more than that. If it was not more than that, they could have gone anywhere else and bought gloves from anybody else. They didn't.
One or two questions on unjust enrichment. Do you recall, you handled a case in the Ninth Circuit against Walmart, Doe versus Walmart?
I did, Your Honor.
So... the unjust enrichment claim in that case seems similar to the one here. Do you think, in order to rule in our favor, in your favor, would we have to conclude that the Ninth Circuit misunderstood the law of unjust enrichment, or can you distinguish it?
Well, I think the main difference is that here, with the Walmart case, we had a number of different settings. Here, we're focused on one factory where there's no doubt at all that across the long-term relationship with Ansel and KCC, that they benefited from this cheap labor coming out, cheap gloves coming from the Brightway factory because of forced labor and trafficking. I think that direct relationship, the ongoing benefiting from it, is different than Walmart, which was really more of a one-off situation.
Suppose I hypothetically think that there's no participation in a venture here. That change your answer?
No, we specifically do not require that there be a venture. That doesn't mean that if there's not a venture because it was just a long-term relationship where they were buying the gloves and getting them cheap, that would be one thing. But it would not mean that they're not unjustly enriched if they are receiving the benefit of those cheap gloves that are cheap because of forced labor and trafficking of our plaintiffs and others similarly situated.
Okay. Thank you.
Was the Ninth Circuit interpreting D.C. law?
No, it was not. I was going to add that. Thank you. We do cite D.C. cases for the unjust enrichment elements.
What's your best case, D.C. or otherwise, for applying unjust enrichment law in a context where the benefit flows from seller to a buyer to a downstream buyer?
And thank you, Your Honor.
Things that, at least superficially, look like market transactions.
Can I give you that case when I stand back up, assuming you're going to give me 1 minute or more for a rebuttal?
Sure.
How much time could I have for rebuttal, please?
Well, we'll set that up. So is there anything more you want to say in response to the question now, or you just want to answer it on rebuttal?
No, I have good cases. I want to just go get them, and I'll instead of wasting your time now. Thank you.
That's right. Any other questions?
Maybe when you stand up, you can also say something about choice of law and why D.C. law is the correct law to apply here.
Okay.
Is that disputed in this case?
No.
Stage?
Yeah, that would be my short answer. It's not disputed, and D.C. is where we filed the case, and the defendants have not challenged jurisdiction or venue, and that's where the case is cited.
And are there cases in D.C. Holding that D.C. common law claims apply extraterritorially?
There's no challenge on that basis either, Your Honor. And they do. The common law, the rule of the presumption against extraterritorial jurisdiction has not been applied to D.C. quote state law, and defendants have not raised that here.
Well, is the unjust enrichment extraterritorial? Or, and put aside your venture theory, I had thought it was simply benefiting from was domestic benefit, much like your 1589B argument.
No, that is correct. But just in the abstract, I don't think there's an issue of whether these laws apply extraterritorially.
There might be issues about state common law applying extraterritorially. All right. Thank you very much. We will give you some time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Morning, Your Honor. May it please the court. I'd like to come back to the extraterritoriality issue, which was a focus of a number of the court's questions. But if I could start with the question of participation in a venture, and Judge Millett, you asked, doesn't this seem very similar to the Apple case? And it does. The plaintiffs had an opportunity after Apple to amend their complaint to try to meet the standard that this court set in Apple. What they came up with was eight paragraphs, at paragraphs 99 to 107. Mostly, they recite several times that this is a buyer-supplier relationship. What Apple held is that a buyer-supplier relationship is not enough. Plaintiffs say you had leverage. You could have withheld your purchases. You had audit rights. Apple addressed those things. It says you can extort your supplier. That's not enough. You can have audit rights. That's not enough. For Ansel, which is one of the defendants here, that's it. It's just the buyer-supplier relationship. With Kimberly-Clark, all they add is this incredibly cursory allegation at paragraph 103.
Cursory is okay at this early stage.
Cursory is okay, but it sort of only gets you as far as you're able to allege. So the question is, what is a plausible inference that you can draw from the allegation that, for example, some machinery was provided, even a significant, I don't want to shortchange the allegation, a significant amount of machinery was provided. How much exactly? How did that help Brightway? Was that integral to its business? the plaintiffs have been shorthanding this idea.
They had alleged the provision of, I assume there was only one factory or more than one.
Your Honor, I can only go based on the allegation. They said at one time, Kimberly-Clark sold a factory.
Okay. But are the machinery and molds provided on an ongoing basis, updated equipment?
Your Honor, this is, I think, why we're getting to the issue of the cursory nature of the allegation. I don't know.
Well, what's a fair inference from the allegation?
A fair inference is that at some point, significant amounts of machinery were provided. I think even if that was ongoing and in a continuous way, I think the only natural inference I can think of is that, you know, as Judge Rao suggested earlier, this is what happens in buyer-supplier relationships. You know, it's one thing to say, I want a bunch of gloves.
What was going on in Apple? That's a big difference from Apple. No, Apple wasn't providing anybody machinery, let alone factories.
No, Your Honor. So I think the question is, you know, what Apple said is you need more than a buyer supplier.
Computer services continually, you're in trouble under Salesforce. If you provide equipment continually, that's okay. That would seem an odd distinction.
Your Honor, I don't read Salesforce as saying if you continually provide computer services, period, then you are participating in a venture. Salesforce had incredibly detailed allegations about the growth.
What makes you think Salesforce is the bare minimum as opposed to an easy case?
Your Honor, I'm not suggesting that it's a bare minimum. I'm following what the court said in Apple, which is this isn't the type. You know, the plaintiffs have said if you have a direct and continuous relationship, boom, you're a participant in a venture. I don't think that's what Apple said. It said if you have the type of relationship that was at issue in Salesforce. And so I'm not saying that Salesforce is the bare minimum, but when you look at what it was about at its core, it was about Salesforce involving itself in the operations of a sex trafficking website.
If you are constantly providing the equipment, updating and sending new stuff every year, plus the buyer-seller relationship, your position is that that's what normal buyer-seller contracts do?
Well, your first, and I take that maybe to be a hypothetical because the constantly point is not played. But if that,
that's the question that I asked.
Yes.
I thought you were saying not good enough under Apple, and that's what I'm. That is the very question I'm asking you.
Sure, and I think it would depend on all of the facts that were alleged, and the reason I say that is because, you know, I take the North Star of Apple to be that the plain ordinary meaning of participation in a venture is that you are in a shared enterprise, you are sharing opportunities for risk. For profit, and you are sharing in the risk of loss. So I think the question is
investing. I mean, they were investing money in this, apart from their buyer-seller contract. I mean, that's at some level, that's a providing, but put that aside. They also were investing money every year in the company, whether in the form of just giving them capital or giving them equipment or giving them high-tech computer services. I'm just
curious
as to why you are resisting that would be different.
I think it might be with enough facts alleged.
Well, I'm telling you the facts.
Okay.
It seems as alleged and that whether that could be good enough for a complaint. And that is, if they said on an annual basis, they are sending in capital investments, equipment, physical manufacturing equipment. High-tech computer services.
I think it would depend. Is it only, you know, to use for the particular products that Kimberly-Clark wants, in which case
They're gloves making factory. As far as we know, that's all they do.
Well, is it because Kimberly-Clark wants their gloves made to a particular specification? And so the same way, for example, if you had a t-shirt factory.
So you think that's what matters?
I think it's relevant. I think it's relevant to sharing a risk.
Doing this, but it's not specialized. It doesn't have a Kimberly-Clark embossment on it or anything. But someone could be actually sort of co-running this business, throwing money and equipment and technology at it.
Your Honor, I think once we get to if you're able to plausibly infer that you are co-running the business, then I think
that's right. My label on what this is when you are providing all of the or lots of, let's say, a significant percentage of the equipment.
Mm-hmm.
Assuming they're the high-tech services and a significant capital contribution, I don't know why you're resisting that.
Your Honor, you know, I guess the question is just whether it's plausible at that point to refer you're running together.
You know, at risk, be at risk. I mean, that's a lot of sunk costs if this business goes belly up.
Sure. Well, I think
it's a WRO against them. That's a lot of stuff you've invested there that's gone. That's not a venture.
I think I would say that I will acknowledge that at some point, if you have enough in there and you have enough riding on this and your profits, yes, I'm not sure, but it's not the one sentence, a significant amount of machinery. I think these things get done on a case-to-case basis. I think Salesforce is instructive.
Well, how do we when write the opinion about, if they've said a significant amount of machinery and it's unclear from the complaint whether it was continuous or not, it's just not specified. Do we have to write the opinion and say we infer it wasn't continuous? We infer that against plaintiffs, and so we won't find a venture here?
I think, Your Honor, good point.
But if they did say continuous, then we would infer otherwise?
I don't think continuous is the be-all and end-all. I think what does it do to the ultimate relation? Is it, I think the question would be, I think what Your Honor asked, that it rises to the level of basically operating the business together. I think that could be a workable standard. And the question
that's
is,
sort of the conclusion
right
that comes from being a venture is that you both got skin in the game. So I don't think you can say that that's the test. I think that's the conclusion. And so I'm trying to understand what you think the test is in an opinion where we do have different allegation than Apple, what it should be for a venture in this context.
I think, are you, is the amount of machinery that is being provided so significant that, one, is this sort of...
They use significant. They use that word.
They do use the word significant. I think that's a conclusion they put in their one sentence allegation. Is it so significant?
It's an adjective describing volume is actually another way to think about it. It's a factual allegation.
Sure, Your Honor. And in Apple, the court referred to, unspecified amounts of purchases. There's sort of...
That was just buyer, seller. I think there was even another in-between person there. That's not what was going on here.
Sure, Your Honor. I think it would look to a couple of things. Are there allegations that this is something that ordinary buyers and sellers don't do? That's not alleged.
No, I don't run businesses. I didn't know that ordinary buyer sellers, arm's length relationships a la Apple, are sending, donating, giving significant amounts of machinery and molds to the manufacturer. Am I wrong? Is that normal?
Well, Your Honor,
does Kimberly-Clark do that, or Ansel? You said Ansel didn't do it. So does that seem like it's part of their business? Does Kimberly-Clark? I mean, one thing you should know is whether your client does that routinely to say domestic manufacturers.
As I understand it, it is normal to have a sort of bailment arrangement where someone is making products for you, and you provide a particular piece of equipment to use to make that product to a particular specification. It's like if you want to mass produce T-shirts
on this equipment.
Your Honor, we're now getting past beyond the complaint, but Your Honor asked, my understanding as to whether this is normal. My understanding is that in these business operations, it is, but there's certainly no allegation that it's not. Apple is a different industry. That's sort of mass production of commodity. I'm not here to say that Apple has exactly the same facts. I certainly wouldn't say that. What it does is have the test.
So were the molds, well, I know, but that's why I'm struggling with trying to apply that test to different facts. That's what this case is about on the venture issue. With the molds, were they Kimberly-Clark specific then? Did it have a little Kimberly-Clark design on it? Is that why they gave them? I don't know how much of a mold you need for a glove. If they had their own specific gloves, it sounds like then what is maybe normal is you give them equipment for manufacturing your gloves, but not Ansel's gloves or anyone else's gloves. Is that what is meant by the machinery and molds?
Your Honor, if we're talking about the allegation, the short answer is I don't know from the one sentence what exactly they think was provided, what they think that it was used for. We don't know the amount. We don't know the purpose. We don't know is it ordinary or is it not ordinary? And we don't know, again, I think Salesforce is instructive in the sense of are you sort of so enmeshed in the business that you are having an effect on the ability for Brightway to run its business, not just can you fulfill the contract for Kimberly-Clark? Is this rising to the level that you are enmeshing yourself in the way that Brightway is running its business? So I think you could have had allegations. So, for example, was Kimberly-Clark the only customer? Was there a fivefold growth like there was in Salesforce, or even double growth? When this factory was sold, or when these machinery was provided?
Kimberly-Clark and Ansel were 2/3 of the purchasers of the gloves from this factory.
I don't think that's been alleged, Your Honor. We know.
I thought it was in the record that the only other purchaser was the National Health Service.
The plaintiffs don't allege anything about how many other buyers there were. We know from a press report that it was incorporated into the complaint that the National Health Service of the UK was another buyer. Mm-hmm. I don't see anything in that article or in the complaint that says those were the only three buyers. It's just more and more and more. And so, one thing I was suggesting was, before Kimberly-Clark was involved, was BrightWay's operation not at scale? And then we also have an allegation that Kimberly-Clark and Ansell stopped buying gloves. Did BrightWay collapse? What happened? That would have been very, very relevant to understanding what is exactly the nature of this supposed dependency on the factory, on the machinery. There's just so little here. And I do think, I completely appreciate, Your Honor, that you want to write the opinion and know exactly where to draw the line.
Be careful, because at some level, these are victims of slavery, forced labor, trafficking. There has to be a line between they've said enough to get past the 12B6 stage, but the other stuff is information that they're not going to know. It's lots of economic injury. Business information is not often shared with your forced employees.
I would want to say Kimberly-Clark and Ansell take allegations like this very seriously. And the point here is, not should there be any response to these allegations of forced labor and supply chains. Congress has taken a number of steps. You have the system working with the withhold release order here. And immediately, as the plaintiffs allege, Kimberly-Clark and Ansell, cut off their ties and stop buying the gloves. The question here is, this is a statute that Congress enacted, and we've got to, give it its faithful interpretation. Congress, at times, I heard Mr. Collingsworth basically describe a form of liability where if you know that something is going on in your supply chain and you buy from that supplier, then you're liable. It would not have been that hard for Congress to write a statute like that. It used a very particular formulation, participation in a venture. So I do think, the court was right in Apple and should here demand that the plaintiffs, really make a showing that this goes beyond a buyer-supplier relationship into something where it looks like it is, as Your Honor well put it, in business together.
The same venture test would apply domestically to a domestic glove manufacturer.
Yes, Your Honor. I think that's the venture test that was applied that was succeeded in Riccio, succeeded in Salesforce. So I don't think our approach here, we're not suggesting they were wrong.
Okay, but that's back to it succeeded there. Those things seemed like, if anything was a venture, that was. But what we need to understand is what is the distinguishing line here. And it can't be that you have to have all that much of the same showing. That seemed to be more than enough. In those two cases,
that was certainly enough. In those cases, I agree. This case is sort of somewhere in between, say, Salesforce and Apple. I think it is a lot closer to Apple than it is to Salesforce. And of course, case by case, judging, there will be distinctions. You have to decide, which side of the line it falls on. But I will say, the question of, under Twombly and Iqbal, it is the burden of the plaintiffs to allege enough. And I think these two sentences about some machinery in a factory one time is not enough to say under the standard, the plain meaning standard this court adopted in Apple, that's not enough to say you are fundamentally in business together, you're in it together, your risks and your profits were rising and falling together. I see I'm out of time. I was hoping to address extraterritoriality, but I'll make the court's...
I just have a question or two on unjust enrichment, which sure, I think is a tougher claim for you, because there does seem to be some authority for the proposition that if a plaintiff confers a benefit on a defendant and that gets passed down a chain, the plaintiff can sue an indirect beneficiary.
Sure, Your Honor. And I'm interested.
So suppose for purposes of this question, suppose I think your colleague on the other side is right that knowledge was adequately pleaded. So you have BrightWay being unjustly enriched through this forced labor, and then the defendants here knowingly taking advantage of that and being they say, unjustly enriched through buying these products at a discount, reflecting the forced labor. I mean, there's a lot of factual assumptions in that. There might be hard questions about how the markets work and stuff, but I didn't see an obvious legal roadblock in unjust enrichment law to prevent them from trying to make an indirect unjust enrichment claim. So help me out with that.
Sure, Your Honor. And so I think the way I would think about this is not direct versus direct, but is there
versus
indirect. Okay. It's was there conferral of a benefit from the plaintiff to the defendant. So I'm interested to hear what case Mr. Collingsworth comes up with as his best case. I suspect it will be a case that's about money. A pays a premium to B, B kicks it over to C, A is able to sue C to recover that premium that was paid. You know, B and C are in a scheme together. They managed to bilk A out of some money. B is the one who initially collects it, gives C their share, then A sues C. We're not talking
easier case if B and C are in the scheme.
Much easier case if they're in the scheme, even if you allow.
Even if they're not in the scheme. I mean, I was really trying to think, like, what is the right legal doctrine to decide how far down the chain you can go? And, like, one possibility might be, is C a bona fide purchaser? And that would seem to turn on, did C have notice of that it was acquiring something illicit? And on this hypothetical, I'm assuming notice. I'm assuming knowledge.
Sure, Your Honor. So I guess, so let me suggest maybe another way of thinking about it, which is to distinguish these the money cases.
Why is that way of thinking about it wrong, too?
Sure. So let's think about what is the benefit this conferred. In these cases where you're sort of following the money down the stream, it's money. You can trace, A paid $1,000 and maybe it stopped with B or maybe it's it went
discount,
to C.
It's a discount reflecting.
Right.
Unreasonable cheapness of labor because right. of the horrible conditions.
Yes, but I think it becomes different when you're asking about the way that unjust enrichment doctrine is phrased is in terms of conferral of a benefit. So what the question is, what did the plaintiffs here confer on anyone? What they conferred on Brightway was their labor. And they allege that they did that under horrible conditions, and we absolutely are condemning that. Brightway benefited from the conferral of labor by the plaintiffs. So the question is, if the plaintiffs had given $1,000 to Brightway, and then Brightway shared some of that with Kimberly Clark and Ansel, maybe we're talking something else. I don't think it quite works to say the labor was then conferred from Brightway. Brightway received the labor, and then they sort of conferred down the chain that labor onto Kimberly Clark.
Yeah.
Well, I think
I'm not an economist.
Right.
It doesn't seem unreasonable to think of it that way. And I mean, unless, I'm not sure if it's the supply curve or the demand curve, but unless there's complete price inelasticity, some of that is going to get passed on, right?
But I think that's right. And I think
some of that value will be passed on to the indirect purchaser of the labor.
And I'm just not familiar with any unjust enrichment case, certainly not one that the plaintiffs have cited that goes that far.
I'm not either. I can't think of the legal magic bullet to say that there can't be one. That's why I'm struggling.
Because I think, now we're very much in the realm of common lawmaking. And I think, we look at, and I think the fact that we're now getting into these complicated econometrics and things like that is a pretty good reason, sitting in diversity, I guess this would be supplemental jurisdiction. I think the court, if it reaches that question, would have to ask, is that really, a step that the common law is supposed to go when adjudicating that claim really would require a common law court to ask these questions about inelasticity of markets and prices and supply and demand curves. It gets really complicated. And I think it gets into questions. We haven't at this stage raised extraterritoriality issues. I think those do loom here. And the other thing that I would say is that we have a statute. Congress, you know, passed a statute that says we don't think there should be a sort of general abstract unjust enrichment concept for supply chains where lots of people down the chain might be buying something that could be tainted at the start. I think a reasonable question for a common law court to ask, should we extend the common law to do all of these complicated economic things in an area, you know, that gets into questions of foreign relations, and, you know, Congress has taken a different approach and a narrower approach. I think that there's a lot of reason for caution, you know, before extending a common law claim into something that really hasn't been seen in the common law before.
Well, do you know if the D.C. Court of Appeals follows the restatement?
I think it does, and I
restatement
don't.
Restatement third says, if the claimant renders to a third person a contractual performance for which the claimant does not receive the promised compensation, and the effect of the claimant's uncompensated performance is to confer a benefit on the defendant, the claimant is entitled to restitution from the defendant as necessary to prevent unjust enrichment. That sounds like exactly this case.
The statement
is restating common law.
Right.
Whether those factors are met, whether the enrichment was unjust or not, I don't think that knowledge, innocent buyer, those things. So, but it seems to me, at least the principle of law that Judge Katsas has been asking about, that I agree with you. I think the D.C. Court of Appeals does follow the restatement. The restatement articulates in the exact terms of this situation an underpayment to the laborer that allows for a cheaper product to the purchaser, allows for a claim against of unjust enrichment against the purchaser.
Sure. Well, Your Honor, I may have missed part of the quote as you're reading. I didn't hear, you know, anything specific to a laborer. Maybe I missed that.
So a contractual performance for which they're not compensated.
Sure. And that could be, you know, the sale of land in any number of things. I guess what I'm saying is just.
But they don't limit it to that.
Sure. And so I think, you know, a restatement is a good place to start. And then one.
Well, you were just saying you weren't aware of any common law principle. And it just seems to me that extent the restatements saying that, making that point in a number of different ways.
Sure. You're
certainly something one would need to at least take into account. I mean, the district court's ruling here was simply a flat can't ever happen. And if that's incorrect, then that's an error.
We're on it.
Without an analysis of whether D.C. Court of Appeals follows the restatement, and then whether the restatement articulations cover the situation.
Right.
You think there might be a difference between wages and land?
We're on it. I think, you know, the principle, I think, common law, you know, adjudicating is all about, you know, how these things apply to different sets of facts. And I think I can think of a lot of situations where there is, you know, labor is provided. For example, you know, Fair Labor Standards Act, you know, someone doesn't pay overtime. The chicken farmer doesn't pay their workers overtime. You could have a fair, you know, an FLSA claim against the producer. Could you have an unjust enrichment claim against your giant supermarket and say, you know, the laborer conferred a benefit on the poultry manufacturer and they passed that along in the form of cheaper price to the grocery store?
About it?
I suppose, Your Honor, that just happened.
I'm just asking you. Yeah. I'm not saying that's what happened here. If they knew about it, the two of them were, all right, we'll we won't pay them that so that your gloves will be cheaper and then you'll have a higher profit margin when you sell them to hospitals and doctor's offices. If there were such knowledge of that sort of passing along a financial benefit, knowledge and intent, what's the objection?
I think the objection is just how complicated it would be to trace benefits.
Tort law does intent all the time and knowledge all the time. It also deals with innocent owners. It deals with bona fide purchasers and not bona fide purchasers. I don't know what's so complicated. This is what happens in the law all the time. And you want to make some global rule that even if someone intentionally, knowingly engaged in this contractual relationship where you cheat them and that will let you give me a lower price, and I am untouchable? And the law can't handle that?
I think the law can handle, I think, you know, some version of what Your Honor just said, you know, starts to look like a scheme. And that, you know, starts to look like these cases where it's, you know, the premiums are collected and you're kind of sort of all agreeing to bilk someone.
So adding more factors in makes it more workable?
I think
scheme now?
What? No, Your Honor, I think the, you know.
I mean, your case is a little more complicated because you talked about a statute. So there are all kinds of issues about common law relators on that. But let's just assume instead it was a common law problem. Underpaid this person, grossly underpaid them.
Right. I think it's.
The law promised them.
I'm not disputing the courts can't handle knowledge and intent. I'm talking about when you start tracing, you know, the value of labor through a supply chain, you know, and does it stop?
Enrichment has been around for a very long time, as have labor supply chains, and it hasn't been a problem. So why is it suddenly a problem now?
Your Honor, I think it hasn't been a problem because I'm not aware of cases like this.
You're talking about the TVPRA. I'm talking about...
No, Your Honor, I'm talking... Right. Oh, sorry.
No. So I think one is an awful lot of times it's an innocent buyer that cuts it off right then and there. You don't have the knowledge.
I think that, I'll take the opportunity to say, I think you know, that could be one way out in this case, because we don't think what they allege here is that the audits didn't...
They definitely are not alleging. There's no allegation here that suggests that, in their view, Kimberly Clark and Ansel are innocent purchasers. Exactly the opposite.
Well, they don't. If you take the complaint as a whole, including what the district court found unchallenged to be materials incorporated by reference, the audits the third party audits that were provided to Ansel and Kimberly Clark found there was not forced labor.
Okay, if that's how we might read the complaint differently.
Can I just ask you a question on extraterritoriality? If we are operating under the second prong of RJR Nabisco,
Your Honor.
Is there any way for the plaintiffs to allege that that the focus of the statute has a permissible domestic effect?
I don't.
What would they have to allege to show that?
Well, Your Honor, what the Supreme Court has said is you look at what is the focus of the statute? What is the object of its solicitude? Who is it trying to protect? You know, I think the obvious thing that this statute is focused on is forced labor, and it's trying to protect, you know, people who are victimized by forced labor and trafficking. So then you would look to where does the conduct relevant to that focus happen? I appreciate the plaintiffs want to say it's the benefit. I have a couple things to say about that.
Doesn't Congress in part say it is the benefit, right? They don't want companies benefiting from participation in a venture that involves forced labor or trafficking.
Sure, Your Honor. And that, I agree, that is an element of the statute, but that's not the end of the focus analysis. I think Your Honor asked a good question before. Why is the focus the benefit and not the participation? The actual statutory phrase is not knowingly benefit from the forced labor, is knowingly benefit from participation in a venture that has engaged in the forced labor.
So perhaps plaintiffs here have not alleged enough, but do you think it's possible where the forced labor occurs abroad for there to be liability for a U.S. company domestically?
Your Honor,
if there was evidence, say, of participation, like if there were venture activities that occurred domestically, would that make it possible to sue a company in the United States?
Your Honor, my position is that the focus of this statute is the forced labor. And so the question is where that came in. I don't think the court necessarily has to reach that question today, because, you know, I think you could leave open the question of whether participation in a venture is enough. I think you'd have to wrestle with things like Doe versus Nestle, where the court says, well, it's not enough to have corporate decision making in the U.S. that causes these harms abroad. I think that might be a complicated issue with that theory. But if you had you know, real significant, you know, you perhaps one could say that the focus of this provision is the participation in the venture. And so if you had, you know, a lot of participation activity in the U.S., again, this is not my position. I think the focus is the forced labor. But I could imagine that position, and it still wouldn't be good enough for the plaintiffs here.
Are you running away from your other argument that the focus of the cause of action is the injury?
No, Your Honor. I think, you know, the injury is being subject to forced labor. So I think that is maybe just another way of phrasing what I was trying to say, or at least I hope so.
Well, you said the focus was being a victim of forced labor.
Yes. That's right.
So if the focus is on when I say forced labor, so the statutory violation, yes. Forced labor, mm-hmm. Victimhood, that's what the cause of action is focused on.
I think that's right. That's what, I mean, just from top to bottom, that's what everything about this statute is focused on. You know, who is the object of Congress's solicitude? It says it, Your Honor quoted this language before, the victim of the violation. So I think, who is the victim? Where were they victimized through forced labor?
That is the exclusive focus of the statute or the primary focus of the statute in under the way we think about that under RJR Nabisco, then there would never be liability for a U.S. company for forced labor that occurred abroad, because the victim, the injury and the victimization would always be overseas.
I think that's right. I could imagine, one thing that Congress was very focused on when it passed this law, there's a lot of immigration related provisions. So I can imagine transnational cases where there's sort of trafficking that overlap that happens, kind of continues from one country. Starts in the United States and somewhere else, starts in a different country and comes into the United States. So I think that could be right. But I agree, Your Honor. I think, with this.
Then there would only be liability for U.S. companies where the forced labor occurred domestically.
I think that's the consequence of what the Supreme Court has applied, time and time again, a muscular presumption against extraterritoriality for very good reasons. As Judge Katsas was alluding to before, it is a very big step to go from a substantive offense that is criminally prosecuted by a United States attorney who is accountable to the executive branch. In some circumstances, by statute, you're supposed to have the express sign-off of the attorney general and the deputy attorney general. The Supreme Court said it's a very big step to then turn this over to private plaintiffs, to sue over things that happened in different countries.
The prong right. One of RJR Nabisco.
Well, you're early. It does, Your Honor, but what all
not I, to whether there could ever be, permissible domestic application of the statute.
No, Your Honor, the only thing I would just, add to that is what, is because the court, at applying this step two, what it has said a couple of different times, that the presumption would be a craven watchdog indeed if it retreated into its kennel as soon as you had sort of any hint of something domestic. So I think in applying the focus standard and in giving it its due, the court is very much, focused on making sure that you don't just have, you don't just kind of, throw out the presumption and the important work that it's doing, by being too lax about looking to, domestic conduct that you see. Say would meet the focus. I think that's why. And I guess my broader point here is this is a fundamentally a decision for Congress, and that is something Congress could decide that it thinks that actually private plaintiffs should be doing these things. And if Congress thinks that that's not the right result, the Supreme Court has told it what to do. Speak more clearly.
Just to be clear, so if you had a company that was in the venture of all ventures. With a Brightway, picked their employees, had their own employees on the ground there, gave them all the equipment they need, kinds of contractual connections between them, ongoing. I mean, it puts Salesforce to shame, this venture that I'm hypothesizing to you. And we've got the memos from the company here in the US saying, gosh, too bad. We're going to have to pay just wages. Wait, how about we outsource it to this company we're going to set up over here? So we are a venture of all ventures. And your position is we don't think Congress wanted that. You stop that?
My position is.
Is it yes or no? Extraterritoriality. Yeah. Does the statute apply to that situation or not?
The civil cause of action does not. That company needs a very good white collar lawyer because they are in a lot of trouble under criminal laws. They can be enforced.
Maybe
be
not. Subject. See who, it's a lot. Our prosecutors have a lot. Attorney generals have a lot on their plates for prosecutions. So maybe not.
Right.
But Congress didn't mean to stop that through civil cause of action, only through criminal enforcement. That's how you read the statute.
I think Congress did not speak clearly enough to overcome the presumption against extraterritoriality to reach that result.
You did that because you said the way you were defining focus was solicitude. Who does Congress have solicitude for? These little victims. I feel bad for victims. Why isn't the focus inquiry, what did Congress want to stop? What did it want to use every tool at its disposal to stop? Well, thankfully, we're at a point where maybe what they wanted to stop was slavery, trafficking, sex trafficking, peonage. And those companies in the United States, President of the United States, nationals of the United States, who knowingly engage in a venture and profit from this process. And you want to say, no, that's not what Congress, it was just one, you know, if you, we feel bad for victims in the United States. Now, if I look at the statute as being, the focus being, make this stop, we are not going to, the United States is not going to be a part of this system, and we are using criminal and civil tools at our disposal. Does that change the extraterritoriality analysis? Or the, not the extraterritorial, the prong two analysis of RJR? If you look at it as a, cut it off.
Right. I guess the question is, what is the it? You know, if the it is the forced labor,
slavery, sex trafficking, all of the criminal offenses. It's pretty clear what Congress wants to stop. It's a lot for Congress to say we're going to apply this overseas. It's a lot to do. And to say we want it to stop, and then to say at numerous points in the statute, and you can't wash your hands of it in this country. You can't outsource it. That will be stopped too, and we will use both the government's own enforcement capacities and private enforcement, because that is a very effective way of making conduct that is reprehensible to the United States stop.
Your Honor.
If that's what the statute does, I think we're right in the core of the gravamen. Tell me why I'm wrong.
Well, I would say the question is focus, not gravamen. When I was using the phrase object of solicitude.
Focus. Stop this.
Yeah.
Conduct.
In the question.
Do not benefit from it in this country.
Your Honor, I think there's two different parts to it. There's the this conduct, and then there's the benefiting from it. I am totally with you. Congress thought this was absolutely atrocious conduct, and I agree with them. Kimberly Clark and Ansel agree with that. Congress wanted to stop this horrible forced labor, peonage, trafficking, slavery. So the Supreme Court says, if that is the focus, where the conduct that is relevant to that focus happened, and it happened in Malaysia and Bangladesh. Where I disagree is to say also the focus in the, that core sense where we're, you know, what the Supreme Court has told us is this is
well,
not
that
a
core sense. There's two. There's another focal point, and that is nationals of the United States that knowingly benefit by participation in a venture that's doing this. That's a focus too. They added it in multiple locations. That is a focus too, is stopping not just Malaysia from having companies that do it, but having companies here knowingly financially benefit from it. I don't know how you can say that is not part of the focus.
It's certainly part of this statute,
but it's not part of Congress's focus.
I would say when you look at the statute as a whole, when Congress added this in 2008, it added the knowing beneficiary liability to 1595 at the exact same time it added 1596 and extended extraterritorial criminal prosecution. So I think when you look at the focus of what Congress is doing, you put aside the step one, step two, just look at a whole at this statute. You know, at the very same time that Congress was expanding civil liability to beneficiaries.
We don't have to do the solicitude test. And look at the focus. We have to look and see whether. So what your test is, we have to look and see whether this, and thou shall not benefit from it financially, knowingly, in this country. We have to say that wasn't part of the focus.
Your Honor, I think what I'm applying is the Supreme Court standard for how you determine.
Question. Can you please? So your analysis says that was not part of Congress's focus.
The focus of the statute is the forced labor, is my position.
Okay. All right. Not all hands on deck to get rid of it.
Your Honor, a lot of hands on deck, criminal prosecution, withhold release orders, you know, a lot of the force of the federal government coming to bear on this. Not the sort of private right of action that the Supreme Court has said causes a risk of international friction, and that Congress needs to be clear if that's what it's going to do.
This friction is nothing like the friction the Supreme Court has talked about. The frictions they've talked about, one, treble damages, which aren't allowed here.
friction is, well, other countries might have their own way of regulating these things, which are predominantly economic activities. NRJ, Nabisco, Morrison, Epigram.
I disagree.
We think Congress here was worried. I mean, it's not, first of all, foreign affairs is something we defer to the political branches. Congress passed this, president signed it. Congress strengthened it, president signed it. And so when we start emptying it, we're stepping out of our role. When we start emptying it of the force that we can tell that Congress, or that we discern Congress intended, that's not our role either. And if we assume there's no solicitude on Congress's part, assumption that it's okay for other countries to make a different choice about forced labor, slavery, sex trafficking, that's not an area, unlike the other cases Supreme Court has talked about, where they want to be solicitude of other countries. If they wanted to be solicitors of other countries, they would not be authorizing the federal government to go into those other countries and start prosecuting people.
Well, Your Honor, they authorized the federal government to do that, you know, with particular checks on prosecutorial discretion involving the express sign-off of the Attorney General and the Deputy Attorney General. I mean,
they're always responsible for criminal prosecutions by the United States. Yes, that's a big deal. It sure doesn't suggest solicitude for other countries making different regulatory judgments about whether to come down hard on these practices, unlike the other cases before the Supreme Court.
Sure, Your Honor. I think all I will say is I don't think the Supreme Court, when it talks about, international friction, it is not just disagreement about, is this bad conduct
trouble,
or not.
Spent a lot of time on treble damages.
Right. I think what I've
talked about is a regulatory, the tension was, well, other countries are regulating this conduct, but they have different line drawing, different ways of bringing that to bear. But no one's arguing here that that's what's being stepped on.
Ron, I think there's also questions of capacity building and bringing things into the United States as opposed to abroad. When you look top to bottom at this statute, there is federal foreign assistance to countries to help them investigate and prosecute. There's sticks. There's penalties on countries that don't conduct proper actions. There's a lot of foreign relations in this statute. And again, I think ultimately it just comes down to a presumption. Congress said, it may be right that the right answer that the political branches would give is that we want private rights of action here, and we want people enforcing this through a private right of action. That's something that Congress needs to speak clearly about. That's our only point.
No question. All right. Thank you very much, counsel. We kept you awfully long time. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, we'll give you 3 minutes, Mr. Collinsworth.
Thank you, Your Honor. Where to begin? I would just remind the court again that in terms of the scope of the statute, I read to you the quote of the sponsors of the bill, and they certainly thought that they were going to stop forced labor and trafficking in the global economy with the amendments to the TVPRA. In that same Nestle case, Justice Thomas, who wrote the opinion, was contrasting the Alien Tort Statute with the TVPRA in terms of its scope. And he said, quote, in 2008, Congress created the present right of action in the TVPRA, allowing plaintiffs to sue defendants who are involved indirectly with slavery. And that's Nestle versus Doe 593 U.S. at 638. All of the legislative history indicates a broad plan to have a tool that would actually stop forced labor and trafficking. And I, with the 3 minutes, I cannot go into the details of our substantive argument on extraterritorial jurisdiction. But I will note that in our opening brief at 10 to 27, our reply brief at 5 to 14, and the entire amicus brief filed by the legal scholars, we think that 1596 extended these extraterritorial predicates, and that caused 1595's exact same extraterritorial predicates to apply extraterritorially. And if they don't, then certainly 1589B applies here, both to extend it extraterritorially because 1596 extends all offenses, or 1589B makes the focus of just that, forced labor, benefiting from forced labor, domestic.
The damages you seek, are they the same for the forced labor and trafficking?
We did not break out the different different categories of damages, just that they were damaged.
Forced labor claim could allow for full compensation of your clients.
Yes, Your Honor. Certainly. I was asked about unjust enrichment. Let me say that the two best cases we have, we cited page 50 of our opening brief, the JSC Transmash holding case, 70 F sub third.
And that one and Campbell.
And Campbell, yes.
Okay, I have those.
Yes, both of them deal with indirect liability, the kinds of issues we're discussing here. And we certainly also discuss Section 47 of the restatement, which Judge Millett pointed out as well. That applies directly here. Now, let me just say that, first of all, we have many allegations showing or alleging that Kimberly Clark and Ansel are benefiting from the forced labor and trafficking by cheap gloves. That's the whole point. Forced laborers don't get paid, so the price of gloves goes down. That's paragraphs 47, 108, and 109. We also show...
One second, do you have any questions? Okay, I think you are over your rebuttal time, and we're aware of what you already said. Yes, I promise you we've read it.
Thank you for your attention, Your Honors. I appreciate it.
Okay, thank you. The case is submitted.